good evening, and welcome to a special joint edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You from Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and by the Piney Woods Audubon Society of Nacogdoches Lufkin, educating people and protecting birds for over four decades. Piney Woods Audubon Society is seeking new members and meets the first Thursday of each month of May through September. Information is on Facebook at East Texas Piney Woods Audubon Society. Tonight we feature Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, along with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and they're here to take your calls about the avian world and the insect world at 800-552-8502. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texan Parks Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. And Dr. Beverly Burton is our resident entomologist and an associate professor of biology of biological sciences at LSUS, a position she has held since 1995. Beverly and Cliff, welcome back.
Hey, happy to be here.
We're excited to have this joint show going.
All right.
Yeah, this is fun.
Folks, you can call in tonight about anything having to do with our avian world or our insect world, both the fiendish and the friendly kind, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All questions are welcome. And we're going to start off tonight, Cliff, if you could remind us, we had a conservation note last month, and we'd like to just talk a little bit about that, because that does lead into our
right.
sort of joint discussion tonight.
Can I do something first? Can
sure
I mention
can.
That? I think in that intro, because I'm a member of Piney Woods Audubon, we have meetings monthly from September through May.
Okay.
I believe you said it, May through September. We don't meet in the hot times, the hot months. So just a slight correction there. We meet September through May, basically during the school year. So anyway, I wanted to point that out. Sorry. So we ended last episode with a conservation tip, as we do every episode of Bird Calls. We talked about the use of local firewood to kind of inform listeners that there are a lot of things hitchhiking in wood, either on wood or in wood. It could be an invasive fungus. It could be an invasive insect. And we pointed out the emerald ash borer. And so what's really perfect is we've got Dr. Burton here today if we wanted to talk a little bit about the emerald ash borer. But the message that we talked about was to keep things local. If you're traveling far away, keep your firewood, get your firewood locally. If you're going to go camping several hours away, get your firewood from near the campground. Don't haul firewood across very far, because you can be hauling these potentially invasive tree diseases and insects with you. Packing crates, pallets are also an issue. It's something that I'm sure a lot of people are scratching their heads thinking, I had no idea. Well, think about it. You know, a lot of these packing crates originate from the country where we're buying goods from, and they get a free ride. They're hitchhiking over on ships or airplanes, and they do just fine board into that wood as maybe a larval stage. And then when months go by and they finally emerge, they're in a whole different country, certainly a different geography altogether, maybe a different biome and completely unique to them. But some of these critters can explode, and we've seen that with the emerald ash borer. And we just recommend people think about that and do your firewood stuff locally. Don't haul it with you far away.
So other than the emerald ash borer, what are some of the insects that could actually and have actually come over from other continents and other countries?
Well, the one that concerns most people right now is the Asian tiger mosquito. That's Aedes albopictus. It actually came over from Japan. And the reason that we're so concerned about that is that it can transmit both the chikungunya and the Zika virus. And I was going to use this as an opportunity to tell people that mosquitoes are out right now, and they should start protecting themselves now. West Nile virus and there's just too many things that you need to be careful with, you know, especially with all the rain we've had. They need to drain all the water. They need not to go out at dusk or dawn. They need to wear, you know, light clothing. And most of all, wear a repellent.
And is that like a repellent on their skin or just on their clothes?
It can work either way.
Okay.
But, yeah, a repellent is different than just like a perfume that covers up your smell. It actually repels the insect. And the DEET is still the tried and true one that we advise.
You are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burton and Cliff Shackelford. And we're taking your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now. And any question regarding our avian world or the insect world, both the fiendish and the friendly kind, are welcome tonight. So let's start off with talking about insects and birds are both pollinators. Let's talk about the interplay between them and the importance of having plants around, native plants and species that can take care of both of these insect populations.
Well, not only do beetles are pollinators, and of course many wasps and bees are pollinators. So everybody, a lot of people just think that it's only the bees that pollinate. And ironically, you know, our honeybee that we have in the United States is not even native to the United States. It was brought over into Jamestown with the colonists. So we have a lot of natural pollinators here as well. Not only do they take care of our wildflowers and other things, but most of the crops depend on pollinators. It's not unusual for farmers to actually rent colonies, have the beekeepers bring their colonies and put them out in the fields to assist in pollination. And so the food on your very table is controlled by pollination. And that's why, you know, Cliff and I were talking before the show, that's why people should do everything possible to maintain a stable natural ecosystem right in their own back in front yards.
So native plants as much as possible, especially for certain local pollinators that would thrive on those?
Absolutely. And if you bring in the pollinators and the natural plants, then all the other natural parts of the ecosystem are just going to follow. You'll have the insects that the birds can come in and feed on. And normally with the immatures, the grubs and the caterpillars and such. And I'll let Cliff have a few words in here.
Yeah, and we've mentioned on Bird Calls about wildscaping, and that's landscaping for wildlife. And that's the focus there is, like Dr. Burton said, is focusing on native plants as kind of the basis for your wildscape, because then everything comes in to feed off of those. And so you want nectar-giving plants to attract hummingbirds, to attract butterflies and other pollinators. And she mentioned beetles. And a book I read said beetles are really one of the bigger pollinators. They're big and clumsy. They get the stuff all over them as they jump into that flower versus, you know, butterflies and hummingbirds that are very dainty and very deliberate and get a little bit on their proboscis or bill, whichever you have, be it an insect or a bird. But beetles are clumsy, and they get that stuff all over them and then fly to another plant. But it's really important to think about these things. If you like to eat that, and Dr. Bird mentioned this, that a lot of the food we eat, we are dependent on insects and other pollinators to bring those to our table. If you like gardens, if you'd like backyard gardens, if you like aesthetics, we have to thank our pollinators. These guys are working for us, and they're doing it for free. And there are parts of the world where they have tomatoes that are grown in greenhouses, and they hire people to do the pollination of the tomato plants. And that's very specific, very difficult. You don't just hire somebody off the street and say, here, do this. It's very delicate. So, but insects can do it a lot better. So I mention that because if we read about declines in birds, declines in our insects, who cares? Well, everyone should care. If you like to eat, you should care.
Absolutely. The one thing that people get a little disappointed in is they'll call me up and they'll say, you know, what kind of plant should I plant to attract the butterflies? Because they want to have a butterfly garden, because who doesn't like butterflies? And of course, it's the lantana and the bee balm and many of the plants like that. And then a couple weeks later, I get a call. Well, I planted those plants and the butterflies came, but now I've got all these caterpillars eating my plants. And they don't understand the connection.
Yeah.
And the problem that sometimes we have in our society is people want everything pristine. Let the caterpillars have a little bit. Yeah. They're probably not going to completely devastate the plant, but that's just, you know, food for the birds and just
well,
and part of the natural
are
ecosystem.
The larvae of the butterflies.
Exactly.
You know, you can so you want more butterflies, you got to let the babies grow, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's real important to learn the host plant for certain species of insect. If you're wanting to track, for example, one of my favorite butterflies, the zebra swallowtail, you need to read up that its host is the pawpaw. There are two species in my area of pawpaw in the genus Semina, and if you want to have a zebra swallowtail, you want to plant one of the pawpaws because that's precisely where they're going to lay their eggs and do their business. And it's right, you want to see some caterpillars because guess what? We've got birds that are going to benefit from those caterpillars, and you want some of these caterpillars to make it to adulthood. You mm-hmm. want the cycle of life to continue.
Now, we've talked about bugs and insects as pollinators. There are birds that do some pollination, too.
Yeah, some of the hummingbirds are important, and it really gets important as you get into the tropics, into higher elevation, when you get over several thousand feet above sea level, and it gets cool and wet, what we call cloud forest. Insects drop out. They can't handle the cool, wet air, that cloud forest environment. So here come the hummingbirds. And guess what? That's where hummingbird diversity is the greatest. And we're talking, you know, 5,000, 6,000 feet in elevation. And there are some hummingbirds that get up to 13,000 feet in elevation where it's so cold, it gets freezing every night. They go into a state of torpor to make it through the night, and there are no insects or very few insects up there to do the job of pollinating. So it just depends on where you are on the planet where birds fit in, but overall insects dominate the art of pollination.
Now, would 13,000 feet, would that be the Andes, or is that in Central America?
The Andes are in South America, so so this would be Colombia, Ecuador, Peru are the main. I mean, it stretches all the way down into Chile too, but the hummingbird diversity is greatest in Ecuador. And that country is only the size of Colorado, yet it hosts about 160 species of hummingbirds, which is roughly 50% of the hummingbirds on the planet. So that one country, Ecuador, the size of Colorado, has half of the species of hummingbirds. And it's got the elevation, it's got the plants that are up high that need the pollination, and the hummingbirds are doing that for the plants.
Because that's about Pike's Peak height.
Yeah.
Pike's Peak is not that much higher than that. Now, over the half of the species of birds on the planet are insectivores. They eat insects. And what insects around here are particularly very important for the native bird population?
Well, I'll tell you one emergence that I've seen, which will stop anybody in their track. If you see an emergence of termites, and when they're coming out, it's usually a cool day after a rainstorm in the springtime, and there could be five or eight different species of birds just really capitalizing on this emergence, which is not an everyday thing, but it is pretty neat to see five or eight species of birds just camping out, attacking these yummy termites that are emerging. That's one example. There are several others. We all wish that there was a bird predator for fire ants. That's another hitchhiker that came into I think Mobile Bay in the 50s. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that's one that just got on the ship by itself. And you know, just like we talked about shipping pallets. If you've ever bought a potted plant in a store. You know, 1 in 20 chance you're going to have some fire ants in there too. You're going to grab hold of this bucket and take it to the cashier, and you all of a sudden you've got 15 stings or bites on your hand because of the fire ants. There isn't a bird predator of fire ants, and that's one thing to keep in mind with an invasive, a non-native species like the emerald ash borer, the red imported fire ant. These guys do well because they're in a new environment without evolving with a predator or something to keep it in its numbers in check, and so that's why they're doing so well. So So unfortunately, we don't have any really good natural control. There's the forid fly. I don't know much about that. Maybe Dr. Burden can mention if the forid fly, which is a predator of the fire ant, has done any good. But I know that's one thing people want to get rid of, are fire ants.
Yeah, indeed. And we do have a call online. We're going to go to our first call tonight. By the way, you are listening to a joint episode, a special episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls Tonight with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford. You can call us at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to Mike from Burke Burnett, Texas. I'm not sure I got the name of that city right. Mike, you're online with Dr. Burden and Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hey, guys. How are y'all?
Very well.
Very good.
Well, good. Thank you for taking my call. And yes, sir, you did get the name of the city right.
That's way up there near Wichita Falls.
Yes, sir. Dr. Burden knows exactly where it is.
Okay, great.
It's my hometown.
My question, though, is I'm a new homeowner, and I would like to plant some native flowers. Where would I find a good resource to find what native plants and native flowers to plant around my home?
Well, since that's Texas, we have the Texas Wildscapes Program. You can go online and look under Parks and Wildlife, and it will go by ecoregion, because no two cities in Texas, you know, unless they're neighbors, really have much in common, right? So you wouldn't want to look what El Paso's planting or Beaumont, but certainly you'd want to look for the Wichita Falls area, the Cross Timbers area up there, and it would give you some pointers of what can handle the climate there and the soil. So those are the two biggies. What's the soil? Is it alkaline? Is it acidic? And then, in a general sense, and then what's the rainfall amount? You want to make sure you get stuff that can handle the rainfall, too.
Also, in Texas, you can go to your local extension agent, and they will give you a soil test kit that you can collect soil and take to them, and they'll tell you a lot about how to implement and to change the soil to grow good native plants.
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. That's very helpful. I appreciate it.
All right. We appreciate the call, Mike. And you are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. We got our next call online, and that is Candace from Shreveport. Candace, you're on with Dr. Burden and Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Forgive me if you've covered this before in a prior program, but I'm pretty curious about the ladybug beetles that we've been inundated with in recent years that are not native to Louisiana.
Well, the thing about ladybug beetles, and when you say inundated with them, is depending on whether it's a natural species or an invasive species, in the wintertime, they're going to be looking for some place to overwinter, and that's when they actually come into the house. And oftentimes they'll seek a certain location, like a southeast or a southwest location in the house to set up and to overwinter with. Now, the good thing about ladybug beetles, whether they're native or not, is that they are still predators. And they are not harmful to us. They're just a nuisance. And a lot of times we can deal with the nuisance because they're out there feeding on a lot of the insects, especially the aphids and other soft-bodied insects.
Wonderful.
The worst thing about having certain ladybug beetles that are invasive to come in is that they compete with the natives. And anytime there's competition, there's going to be a winner and a loser. And it might suppress the native lady beetles. But there's a lot of different species of lady beetles. A lot of people don't realize that. They think of the classic lady beetle, but there's actually one that is black that just has two red spots on it. And they so give the lady beetles a good, just give them a try. They're good to have around.
Well, we've got a lot of them, and we have a tower in our church with bells in it, and they literally are everywhere at certain times of the year. And then we have an old house, and so they managed to get in through the attic, I guess.
So they might.
Are those Baptist beetles then in the church or Catholic?
No,
or?
No, these are Episcopalian.
Oh, Episcopalian. I was going to say that one next.
Yeah. But that's good to know. I'm glad they eat aphids. If they eat aphids in my garden, they can stay as long as they want.
And their immatures are In fact, sometimes the immatures of ladybugs are called aphid lions, not to be confused with ant lions. That's something that's completely different. But they are beneficial as long as they don't do too much detrimental aspect to the native species.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Cool. Right. Thanks, Candace.
Thank you. You are listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go to next to Robert from Pineville. Robert, you're online with Dr. Burden and Cliff. What's your question?
Okie dokie, folks. So here's a deal I'd like for you to substantiate, which is it's not even Googleable. So I'm looking at this crow landing on a pile of ants. The crow scratches around in the ants. He's either on Budweiser or Mogan David. He scratches around like he's doing a breakdance on the ant pile. Oh. And then pretty soon he flies off. Now, I've been told by folks that this is a miniature car wash for mites that are on birds, or crows specifically, that the acids from the excrement will deteriorate, or rather clean the bird of mites. And that's my story. You would like to confirm that, or that's a lot of bull?
No, I like the way you called it a breakdance. I thought that was clever. and that's exactly what they're doing. It's called anting. Mm-hmm. You'll see some birds sunning to keep their feathers maintained, or dust bath to keep their feathers maintained. And anting is another form of maintenance. So you mentioned car wash, and that's another good analogy too. So I like the way you put it, and we might have to have you come on the air and tell us more, because you say it so well.
You've answered my question rather than trying to find it on the whiz box or somewhere
else. Right.
So you answered my question. The next thing is, pine needles that you can, green pine needles that you can rub on you and will be a mosquito repellent, because today the snake oil they have in these off products doesn't make your body happy. So I was wondering either some way to tell me, yes, this is full of bull, or yes, you can rub pine needles on you as a deterrent from mosquitoes. Yes, no.
There's a lot of plants that will produce what we call allele chemicals, and a lot of the plants that produce certain types of oils, and pines do produce a certain type of oil, and that will get on your skin. Now, it's not a repellent. It's just covering up the natural smell of your body so that they may not be quite attracted to you. They may go off and bite somebody else. And so I've never heard of pine needles, but there's all kinds of people will rub mint leaves on them, and other natural plant oils.
Now, Robert, in Pineville, you've got a plant that's got an oil that I don't want you to rub on yourself. It's called poison ivy, okay?
Holy moly.
Okay, you stay away from that, my friend.
Bless your heart, and thank you for answering these mysterious questions.
Okay, good ones you posed to us. Thank you, Robert.
All right, you are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden, and we have lines open right now, almost all lines open, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to David from Shreveport. Dave, you're online with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question?
Okay, I don't have Martin houses myself, but this year, as I drive around town, seems like to me I see a lot of vacant Martin houses.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there was a problem that they are diminishing or not, didn't make the trip this year, or just what was going on.
Yeah, the problem is peer pressure. And what I mean by that is you'll see your neighbors doing it or your friends down the way, and you'll say, I want to do that. And if it's your exact next-door neighbor, you're sharing the same purple martin. So what we've done is we've saturated the environment, some environments, with too many purple martin boxes. It's just not feasible. So it's one of those things, if your friend has it next door, you just need to get your lawn chairs over by the property line and enjoy their box. Don't try to put the box in your yard, because think about it. They're using so much airspace that they're covering your whole subdivision, that one box is, okay? So that's one thing I've noticed, is that there's too many out there, and I don't want to deter people from putting it up, but I also tell them, if you put one up and there's one down the way, you can't have it both ways. You can't suck those birds over to your side too. So I think that's what you're saying, is that we've gotten too excited about trying to attract them, but we haven't really thought about what does it take to get purple martins. And the answer is it's tough. It's very tough.
And what do they need in the ecosystem, the ecology, the food source, basically? Is there enough?
We had
discussed this before. Purple martins are or are not a good carnivore for mosquitoes.
Well, there are plenty of birds that eat mosquitoes. I'm not sure about purple martins.
They're not good at eating mosquitoes.
Purple martins aren't.
No, and I've had to mention that.
That's one of those mythologies that's out there.
Oh, it's a five-decades-long still effective advertisement is, if you have mosquitoes, get purple martin box. Well, purple martins actually eat more dragonflies, and the dragonfly is your better predator of mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly because they're both wetland inhabiting. You've got the larval stage of the mosquito in water, and the same with the dragonfly. Right. So they've kind of co-evolved, but we create these wetlands. We talked about mosquitoes in the beginning of the show. We've in human environments, we've created these wetland settings where only the mosquito can make it and not the dragonfly. So if we have outbreaks in our neighborhoods, it's because we've done it. We've got clogged leaf drains and gutters. We've got buckets out back that are full of water, stagnant. We've got the wheelbarrow turned up where it's catching rainwater. We haven't looked at it. We've got old tires. So I think if you're really worried about mosquitoes, and you should be, as Dr. Bird mentioned, the cleaning up your yard is a number one, and pressuring your next door neighbors, because mosquitoes can fly several doors down. So it's not just your yard, but if you look over the fence and you see someone's collecting tires and they're just sitting there, you probably need to take some action, because there's going to be stagnating water in there, and that's a perfect breeding situation for mosquitoes. So a lot of the mosquito outbreaks we see are human-induced.
And how do we attract more dragonflies then, if we want to eat mosquitoes?
Well, you have to have the right environment for the dragonflies. And they like to have... Not so much wooded areas, but tall grasslands and things that there's going to be not just mosquitoes, but other insects.
Okay. You are listening. Is that the last of your question, David?
One more.
Okay.
Before humans began building shelters for purple martins, where did they nest?
That's a great question. And you can see it out west. The birds in parts of the Southwest we'll use old woodpecker holes that are in snags where there's multiple holes. And you've probably seen that. You can see a tree, a cottonwood stub that's got five or eight holes in it, used by multiple years, multiple families of woodpeckers, and the tree's still standing. You know, it's arid climate. The tree doesn't rot and fall down as much as it would in, say, Florida, where you got 70 inches of rainfall. But out in the Southwest, that those trees can really stay standing for a long time. So that's the answer, is they used stobs and snags that were riddled with multiple cavities because they didn't all get into one hole, just like the apartments that we put up for purple martins. It's multiple cavities that are separated. So it's just like that apartment we put up where their front doors might be near each other, but they don't, once they go in, they're not in the same chamber. And
right.
you get that with those old snags and those old woodpecker riddled holes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that pretty much answers my question. So I'll let someone else have the airwaves.
Okay, great. Thank you, David.
David, thank you very much for calling in. And we do have all lines open, or all lines closed right now. We're full up. We're going to go next to Julie from Nacogdoches. Julie, you're online with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question?
Hi there. Well, I'm going to continue the thread of mosquitoes. And I wanted to ask, so we've done a really good job, I think, of providing a native wildscape in the back for birds and butterflies. That's been our emphasis for a long time. And, you know, we can only do so much about what the neighbors do and emptying water and out of buckets and tires and things like that. So short of having our guests rub pine needles over themselves when they come to visit, I guess my question is more specific. We don't want to use pesticides or insecticides. We don't want to spray because we're trying to attract the, you know, the birds and the butterflies and and the bees, things like that. So about a year ago, I purchased at great expense one of those mosquito vacuums that uses propane, and it's supposed to and it's got a Lurex attractant. So that's the chemical that you put in the top, and supposedly it sends the pheromone out to, and it can supposedly cover an acre. And I've heard from other people that this worked really well to fight mosquitoes, but for me, it didn't work really at all. And so I'm wondering if I'm doing something wrong, or Beverly, if you have an opinion on those mosquito vacuums, and maybe we should just give up, or is there something, some way we can tweak it?
There's been the mosquito vacuums that are trying to mimic the pheromone of mosquitoes, but I have never read where they have been very successful. People also have tried to take and buy dry ice, and as the dry ice sublimates, it releases the CO2 that they may be able to lure the mosquitoes over to that direction. There is a little bit of benefit from that. But I think you're doing, if you don't want to use insecticides, you're probably doing the most you can. Some people will take and try to use smoke as a deterrent as well. And that's just clogging up their sensors to where they can't smell their host. And so I'm sorry you had that experience. But, you know, if there was a magic bullet out there, everybody would be doing it and everybody would have one. And it may be that some of your friends are having better success because of their way that their backyard is designed, so that, you know, a lot of vegetation versus not very vegetation, because mosquitoes do rely on vegetation as a resting place when they're not feeding.
So is there an insecticide that gets rid of mosquitoes but isn't going to hurt other things?
Well, there's something that's been kind of done, but there's a derivative of the black pepper plant. It's called pepperine, and some people have been experimenting with that. But if you log on to the CDC or any other area, they're going to tell you just to use a repellent on your body. People don't like that, but, you know, it is what it is. And the citronella candles do work to a certain extent because they, again, will mask the smell that the mosquitoes are attracted to. Sometimes people have used eucalyptus oil as a positive result of deterrency as well.
Okay. So when I try and sell this mosquito vacuum on Craigslist, don't tell anyone that it doesn't work.
Yeah, don't tell them that Dr. Beverly Burton endorses it.
Yeah. Or Red River Radio.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Julie. And you are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. And we have some lines open right now, and we're going to go next to Jeff from Shreveport. If you'd like to call in, 800-552-8502 is the number, 800-552-8502. Jeff, you're online with Dr. Burden and with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, there are two things I saw that I'd like to have explained. One in Shreveport and one in Michigan. In Shreveport, last year, I was at around sunset, I was looking at a swarm of gnats. They were between me and the sunset. And I was wondering how well I could videotape that. Now, while I was looking at that, I noticed some very fast-moving predators moving through the swarm. I could not see the predators. They weren't dragonflies because I could see dragonflies. But they were very fast moving, just zipping through the clouds. Do you know what those could have been?
My guess is that they weren't predators. When you see midgets and gnats swarming like that, normally it's a reproductive swarm, and the females are coming into the swarm of males, and the females are coming into the swarm, and it's just competition on which one gets the female. And so it would be more probable that it would be the female coming and going from the cloud of midges.
Hmm. Okay, because, I mean, this was like a bullet going through the cloud just over and over again. But okay. But the second thing that I was that I saw, and this is like 40 years ago in Michigan, I spent 6 weeks in the woods. And there were these, we would call them conversation stoppers. They looked like spiders falling from the sky. You know, they were very wispy. They were very, very colorful. And you could barely see them. And once they got below the tree line, they were very hard to follow. We never caught one. There was one we caught, well, we almost caught it with a nylon net, but it broke apart. But if I could say how it was colored like an oil slick. It was psychedelic.
Hmm. Iridescence, maybe?
I don't know.
And it was,
we never got a good look at them. I saw one of them broken up in the grass, and it was hard to really see it.
And 40 years ago, it's been bugging you ever since. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Yes.
Jeff, my best guess on that is that there are a lot of spiders that will do something that's called ballooning, where they will let out a stream of silk, and that silk will be caught up in the wind. And it's just like flying a kite with a string on it. And it, eventually everything that flies must fall. And that may be just the break in the woods where the currents weren't that strong and they were going ahead and landing, and that's where they would need to make their home. And there's a lot of spiders that have little iridescent colors. One of my favorites are jumping spiders in the Salticidae family. Are very, very iridescent.
Tiny little things, too.
They are very, they can
I
be very small.
I have a pet in my bedroom, so I know. Yeah. So.
These were quite large, but they had no body. And their legs were like hairs.
Well, you know, most spiders' legs are very, very hairy, spiny as well.
Almost sounds like a small daddy long leg.
Well, it could also be a lynx spider. Lynx spiders are very, very hairy and spiny.
Hmm. Right. Well, I said it like hairs. I mean, it was pin-like hairs. It was like a daddy long legs with no body, very colorful, falling.
Mm. Yeah. You know, the other thing that daddy long legs are sulpugids, not sulpugids, but opalanids. But I don't. They don't have silk glands, so they would not be ballooning the way other spiders do. So that would be my answer to that.
Okay, Jeff?
Thanks a lot.
All right, you bet. You are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. We've got calls online and a couple of lines open right now. We're going to go next to Polly from Texas. Polly, you're on with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question?
Well, hello. I have some bird calls that I have put on my phone, and I'm just... We love the birds. We feed the birds. We also accidentally feed lots of squirrels. Mm-hmm. And I have several calls here on my phone recorded, if you can hear it. Do you think you'll be able to?
Yeah, let's give it a try. Let's try one. Just put it up to your phone and let's listen.
Okay, here
Go
it
ahead.
Comes.
Yeah, that's a Carolina wren. And Bill's got a better recording of that if he's got it at his fingertips. Carolina Wren. Let's listen to what Bill's recording. That's good. We could hear it. Yeah. And it's the same note over and over. It's very loud, very repetitive. And we've mentioned this on the radio show. This is the one that's outside your bedroom window before the alarm goes off. So that's the Carolina Wren. We've got one in our backyard that loves to get under our patio, our covered patio. It gives a very nice echo. and really boosts the volume of his song. So that one's the Carolina Wren. Do you have one other quick one on there real quick?
I think so.
Okay, different one?
Yes,
okay.
I hope so.
Okay, go for it. Same species, same critter. Yep, that's still the Carolina Wren.
Just a different kind of call.
Could be the same individual. They just change out what they say. One of the things that some people think they sound like they're saying is cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheeseburger.
Yes, I hear that.
And then sometimes it sounds like it's saying judely, 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 judely. So you can probably phonetically put any kind of words in there. But both of those recordings are the same critter.
Oh, it's a wren.
Yeah, Carolina Wren.
They're
close to our house. People have them nesting in shoe cubbies or in the garage if you leave the door open. We often think, well, they must be a house wren because they're nesting around the house. No, we don't have house wrens down, at least in the Red River Radio listening area, as a nesting bird. We do in the winter, but the one we see around our home that you recorded is the Carolina Wren.
Carolina Wren.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much.
Very good.
Thank you, Polly.
Thank you, Polly.
And that would be the one that wakes me up at 5 in the morning, indeed. You are listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now, and we're going to go to Mary from Shreveport next. Mary, what's on your mind tonight? You're on with Cliff and Dr. Burden.
There's something really bugging me. It's carpet moths in my house. I do have some wool carpets. I've lived here for almost like 30 years, and I've never had this problem before. And I had them all taken out, every single one of them taken out and cleaned and treated, and they're laid back down, and the moths are back. So I'm... some people have told me that there is an outbreak, of carpet moths in my neighborhood, which was also a couple of years back the epicenter of the West Nile virus, incidentally. It's an area with some older homes in Shreveport, and I just don't know what to do now. I'm not getting any real suggestions from the pest protection people that I have, and I'm kind of stumped.
There's an old trick that you can use for individuals that are living in carpets. Now, when you say that you had the carpet moth, are you seeing the adult flying part of their life cycle, or are you actually seeing the immatures, the little caterpillars?
Both.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's something that Cliff and I were talking at the show, you know, do you treat the caterpillars because they'll give rise to the moths, but the moths will give rise to the caterpillars? Do you know what they treated your carpet with?
I don't, really.
Okay. Well, just because they said it's treated doesn't mean that it was treated, you know, against carpet moths. If it was mine, you can do this old trick. Take regular table salt and just spread it over the carpet. Let it stay there for about 24 hours and then vacuum it up. And that salt will actually kill the immatures. It will desiccate them. It'll make them dry out. And then you just, vacuum up the remains and then just monitor it and keep vacuuming on a daily basis. And pretty soon you'll take care of the problem.
Awesome.
Now, and that actually works for fleas as well.
That's one I have not heard or seen. I've looked it up on the internet, you know.
That's an old one to try, and it does work really good with carpets. And my email address is beverlyburden@lsus.edu. Email me and let me know how that works, if you don't mind, Mary.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
This is a new thing. I've heard vinegar, which I've tried.
That's smelly.
Yeah,
but, you know, anything. I'll do anything.
Yeah, try that. Try the salt.
See how it works. You might have to do a couple of treatments too. I mean, you know, it's just salt, so it's not going to be a problem. So
right, I'm watching one fly around that right now in the room, and it just irritates me no end.
Okay, thank you very much, Polly, for calling in. And you are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I've heard of salting the earth, but salting your carpet, that's a good one. I like that. So we're going to go next to Paul from Shreveport. Paul, you're online with Dr. Burden and Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hello.
Hello.
Paul from Marshall.
Oh, okay. They had you down from Shreveport.
Yeah, called in last week and talked to you about cattle. I was fishing up on the north end of Lake of Pines, Big Cypress Bayou, where it meets Highway 259.
Right.
And hundreds of large black birds. I think the slang name for them may be water turkey.
Yep.
But they were flying in V's, and it took them, I don't know, 5, 6, 8 minutes to clear where I was at. That's how many there were.
What day was that?
What day was that? Oh, my gosh. 3 weeks.
Okay.
3 weeks ago.
Because I saw a big flight of them on Tuesday last week. And so this is the time of the year where the double-crested cormorants are going back north.
They are cormorants.
Yep.
I asked my buddy if he thought they were, and he didn't. I don't know. He thought that they were a smaller bird than that.
Yeah, well, your buddy probably doesn't know what he's talking about, huh?
Well, if there's that many of them and you've seen them, well, then I'll take your word for it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because you described them well. They're near water. They're in V formation, and they're headed north. And if you guys are anglers, you're happy because these are fishermen too, these birds.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, you know, they get a bad rap, but they're eating bait fish. They're not eating sport fish. So, and most of our double-crested cormorants breed up in the Great Lakes and southern Canada. So they are on their way north for the breeding season. Yeah, we have very few double-crested cormorants that stay in Texas or Louisiana to breed. There are neotropic cormorants, a different species that will be here and dominate as a cormorant breeding sites, but not double-crested. So, yeah, what you witnessed was the northbound flight of a bunch of double-crested cormorants.
Now, when I lived down in the Houston area, I mean, there are cormorants further south. They're there year-round, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's, you know, when I mentioned the neotropic cormorant, that as you get farther south, it's a little smaller than a double-crested, but looks identical. If you're not using binoculars or scope, they just have the superficial shape and jizz, what we say, of a cormorant, general impression of size and shape. And so that's the neotropic cormorant. But, yeah, the double-crested will go all the way down into Mexico and all points in between the breeding grounds and down there. So we have every lake of size in Texas is going to have, and in Louisiana is going to have double-crested cormorants in the colder months.
I got you.
Yeah.
Now, I called you a couple of weeks ago, and I don't remember telling you that about this episode because we also had pelicans up there.
Yeah.
Bunches of them.
And that's another one that people will see big flights of those this time of the year as they head north as well. So American white pelicans, we have small breeding population. I mean very small near the Corpus Christi area. And then the rest are all migratory. They go up to the Great Plains like the Dakotas and eastern Montana for breeding. So,
okay, cool.
Yeah. So pretty soon we won't have hardly any double-crested cormorants or white pelicans left in Texas because they're all gone in the winter. Now, people always find the exception. I've been to Lake Livingston Dam in the hot months, and I've seen white pelicans. They're not injured. They're probably first-year birds that just haven't figured it out. They're not ready to breed. They're not ready to migrate. They're like, hey, it's pretty cool hanging out right here.
And a lot of fish to eat, too.
Yeah. So, you know, be prepared to see the exception to the rule. And that's one thing you learn real quick when you do biology is the book says it's supposed to be this way, and then all of a sudden you see a variant, an anomaly. And I think that's what makes all this so darn unique and interesting is you can read it in the book one way and then go out in nature and see it maybe tweaked a little bit. So, but don't freak out if you see a white pelican in the winter. In the summer months, it could be one of those young birds that just hasn't figured it out.
Okay, good deal.
Good.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm going to run.
Okay, Paul, thank you.
All right, thank you, Paul. And you are listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open right now. Time for more calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Anything regarding our avian world or our insect world, both the fiendish and the friendly kind. And we've got Frank from Shreveport next. Frank, you're online with Dr. Burden. And Cliff, what's your question?
My question is about mosquitoes.
What about mosquitoes, Frank?
I know we talked about mosquitoes earlier, and Beverly mentioned the CDC and repellents. But in scouting in my youth, our scoutmaster would talk about sulfur and cream of tartar tablets. Or chewing the heads off of wooden matches, the sulfur. I haven't been able to find sulfur in cream of tartar tablets. So what is the effectiveness of those remedies?
If they worked, we would still be doing it. You know,
right.
So I think it's probably just an old myth, an old tale. And I wouldn't suggest taking anything that I wouldn't really trust. And like I said, there's a lot of different things that people do. Sometimes people claim that they just, especially for ticks, like they'll just put kerosene around the bottom of their pants to keep ticks off them. And so there's a lot of little tricky things that work. But taking in different supplements, like I said, if it worked, we'd be doing it.
Right.
And I'd be careful about sulfur. I mean, there are a lot of people, including myself, that are allergic to sulfur. Sulfur drugs. But if I get too close to sulfur, like a sulfur mine, I've experienced that. Or if you're close to shooting rockets when I was a kid, I had to be careful. Matches, I would break out on my hands in these blisters. And it was unbelievably painful. So I wouldn't start popping sulfur pills for my kids, not knowing if they're allergic or not, because I had to go to the hospital, and I had something called erythema multiformis. I'll never forget that Latin name, because those lesions on my hand, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't itch them. I'd have to dunk my hands in ice water to get some relief until my hands felt like they were going to freeze off. So sulfur is pretty rough on a small percentage of the population, and I'd be real careful. So when I'm around people that use the sulfur sock to keep chiggers away, I don't get anywhere near that when they're puffing away with that sulfur sock. I would use Permanone, or as long, you know, it looks dorky, but tucking in your socks can help. It's not it's not the only thing you can do, but it's chemical free. And so I do that, even though I look like an English golfer with my knickers on. But
you're talking about tucking your pants into your socks.
Tucking my pants into my socks.
Right.
Looking like a dorky golfer.
Yeah, it keeps access down to your legs.
Yeah,
so that's where they're trying to get to. All right, we have two more calls online, and we're going to go next to Doc from. We're not sure where you're from, Doc. Tell us where you're from.
Well, actually, I'm from Natchitoches, Louisiana, but I live south of that, so you could say Natchitoches.
That'll work.
I have a question. The gentleman was just talking about mosquitoes. I'm a DJ, and I was out in Alexandria a couple weekends ago, and a gentleman was spraying stuff around, and I asked him, I said, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm spraying for mosquitoes. And I said, well, what are you using? And he said, the water and soap. I said, well, what kind of soap? Well, bacteria soap. Now, guess what you wash your hand in. But it worked, but they also had those candles out there with fire on it, you know, for smoke and stuff. So I don't know. I'm just asking about that, the soap and the bacteria soap and water. Have you ever heard that before?
Well, there is such a thing. It's called a safer soap. It's an insecticide that's effective against soft-bodied insects, which mosquitoes are. And as well as their immature. So if he's just using regular antibacterial soap, that'd be one thing. But he may also be talking about something else, which is what we call BT. It comes from bacteria, from a bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis, and they produce a chemical that's effective against the immatures of mosquitoes. And you can buy it locally. They're called mosquito dunks or mosquito donuts. People put them in their koi ponds and stuff, and it's effective against mosquito larvae, but it's not effective against the fish or any of the other wildlife.
Okay.
So it depends on what kind of bacteria he was talking about. It could go either way.
All right. Thank you for calling, Doc. We've got one more call that we've got to get to, and this is Billy from Jasper. Billy, you're online with Dr. Burden and Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Thank you very much. This is for Cliff, but it's something that's bugging me. I know you heard that there was a knockdown down at Sabine Woods. They got 23 warblers on Sunday. But what's bugging me is I haven't seen a painted bunny in 15 years or an Acadian flycatcher.
Okay. Well, for our area, for Jasper, and I was just down in Northeast Jasper yesterday, and I wouldn't have expected to see or hear a painted bunny yet. They seem to be... at least territorial males really get settled in the latter half of April. Now, some migrants could come through. They're going to be maybe quiet, not detectable.
Quiet, yes.
But your bird should be along weedy fence rows starting in the April 20s. I would think you could drive around and find them. And then Acadian flycatcher, I didn't have any Acadians yesterday either. The new birds for me for the year I had yesterday in Northeast Jasper County were Prothonotary warbler, Swainson's warbler, and broad-winged hawk. I saw all of those were new for me for the spring. These are birds that winter in the tropics and come back.
Oh, yeah. I see them every summer.
Yeah, but your Acadians should be around any day now as well. And I think that if you drive around weedy fence rows along roadside, you'll find a painted bunting.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, okay, thanks for the call.
We've been at Danby together before.
Oh, okay, great, Billy. Good to hear from you.
All right, and thank you for calling, Billy, and thanks to everybody for calling in tonight during our joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls. And Cliff, you were mentioning how you read a book and then it goes out and change, and then we have to remember that nature is always writing new chapters its own book on a daily basis. So thank you both for joining me tonight.
You're welcome.
We had fun.
All right. You have been listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford. The producer for tonight's show is Bill Beckett, along with Dr. Burden and Cliff Shackelford. And the audio for tonight's program will be up on our website in just a short while. This program is produced in the studios of Red River Radio. It was made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, as well as the Pineywood Audubon Society of Nacogdoches Lufkin, educating people and protecting birds for over four decades. The Pineywood Audubon Society is seeking new members to meet the first Thursday of each month, September through May. Information on Facebook at East Texas Audubon. Thank you for joining us tonight, and stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next.